good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. In this episode of Newton Talks, my guest is Adam Heron, a PhD student from Northumbria University. His research project is entitled Queering the Porn Theatre, Sexual Spaces in New York City from 1967 to 1980. And his research looks at a largely undocumented strand of grindhouse history and culture. And this is an area of exploitation cinema that I am particularly interested in myself. Adam's research is a way of thinking about the history of pornography and other marginal areas of film. Adam, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So do you want to start by telling me a little bit about your PhD and where the idea for it came from and what sort of area you're going to be researching?
Absolutely. So to sort of start, it would probably help to bring it back to the sort of progression in terms of my own education. So when I was studying for my BA, I was based at Northumbria University in the Media and Journalism program. For that, that gave me a lot of practical skills. But in my final year, I thought that I would explore the theoretical side of media studies. And through that, came into contact with Dr. Johnny Walker. Through that, we just started to think about ideas and how we could explore the crossover between the practical side of journalism and the theoretical side of media studies, in which I came to the sort of product of the undergraduate dissertation, which talked about the presence of media ethics and the function of death in two case study films, which were Man Bites Dog and a Serbian film. From there, I studied an MA at the University of East Anglia, and that was in film studies. And from that, I got a lot of the methodological qualities which would go on to inform the focus of the PhD. A lot of the modules which talked about the film studies from the perspective of theory, history, and criticism really gave me that sort of new insight into the subject matter, which I would work with Professor Mark Yankovic, who was based at the University of East Anglia. During the MA, I took a case study of the film Snuff, which was released in 1976, and from that I took that through a case study of its production, distribution and exhibition in New York City. And part of that, which really interested me, was the fact that people talked about the film in a very sure-minded way, that it was a horrific film, and critics would describe the film as playing in an absolute, like, black hole, a blot on the landscape of Times Square. Yet it was playing at the National Theatre, owned by Mann Cinema Chain, in which the theatre was newly built in 72. During the run, it was serving hot buttered popcorn and playing Woody Woodpecker shorts in between. But a lot of the critical reception of the film talked about it from the perspective of an image which was already made up in the minds of critics. So from that, that leads me to the sort of intervention I hope to make in the PhD. Work that has come out in terms of cinema history on the back of publications such as Explorations in New Cinema History in 2011, and also a dossier on adult film history from SCMS, co-edited by David Church and Eric Schaefer in 2018, has talked about a lot of the sort of revisionist histories and this new sort of archival turn towards looking into film history, not just as what is being talked about on the screen, but taking it forward in terms of earlier interventions in the methodology of reception studies to sort of interrogate a few of the assumptions that we carry out. So in the work of David Church, he talks a lot about the history of the grindhouse and talks about how whether the grindhouse was even a place or it was more just a retrospective framing of cinema culture in certain places during a certain period, and how that has been affected by video distribution and fan cultures celebrating that element. But the way in which I want to make my intervention is to talk about how a lot of that sort of culture is put through a very heterosexual male viewpoint, and as a result, you get histories of the grindhouse, which talk about the usual suspects of the Rialto, the Lyric, and the New Amsterdam, but leave out a lot of the porn theaters, which were operating in proximity and sometimes in collaboration with a lot of the cinemas, which were showing exploitation and film.
Queer porn theatres are separate theatres to the grindhouses like the Rialto and the Times Square and all those other grindhouse cinemas.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they're in the same space. They're in Times Square, are they? These spaces.
Yes, we have this really interesting sort of like sexual economy in the Times Square district, which has existed for over a century in that sort of landscape. We have Mark Yankovic and Tim Snelson's work on the Rialto in the 1940s talks a lot about how the cultural geography of Times Square has always existed as a privileged sexual space for interaction for the gay community in New York for reasons they give, such as it was a space which was obviously in the heart of the theatre district. There was a lot of transient youth and young men in the post-war period who would be present in the district. It was also a tourist attraction. It was a hub for entertainment, for lack of a better word, and but not just on the level of going to see the show, but also part of the appeal which would be kind of explored in queer publications such as zines such as The Advocate and sometimes even travel guides like a scholar based in the US called Lucas Hildebrand talks about how elements of tourism in not just New York but around the world would specifically mention these cinemas and would roadmap them in much the earlier traditions of the sort of more clandestine elements of gay history, in which it was punishable by imprisonment and was very much a hidden practice in which it would be reliant on this sort of subculture of signals and landmarks to where people could meet like-minded individuals.
So what would happen in what is playing in these kind of gay porn theatres? Is it just movies, or is there live shows as well? What kind of programming was happening in these theatres?
Well, this is a very interesting question, and it definitely is relevant to my title of Queering the Porn Theatre, in that you mention the porn theatre and immediately, just like as the grindhouse, it builds up an image in your mind of a very solitary experience in which we have terms such as the raincoat brigade, which refers to the sort of baggy clothing which patrons would use to enter the theatre and exit the theatre in relative privacy. But in terms of this theatre space itself, it would be screening a mixture of softcore and hardcore material, and I talk about this distinction in my paper, which I'm currently in Birmingham to give at Cine Access, in which Eleanor Gorfinkel's work on sexploitation, her definition of softcore emphasises the simulated qualities of sex while retaining full frontal nudity, whereas Linda Williams' definition of hardcore in her a much cited work, Hardcore, is contingent on the visibility of unsimulated penetrative sex. So we have a mix of softcore and hardcore films being shown in the theatres over time, but as you've mentioned, it was not just what was on the screen which would be an appeal. We have ethnographic work from academics such as Jose Capino, who talk about the historical presence of live sex shows, and they talk about the sort of mobility of what is meant by a porn theatre in Times Square at the time. We have not just large theatre spaces such as the Adonis Theatre on 50th and 8th, but we have storefront theatres, we have back rooms in adult bookstores, and all of which would be showing material. But at the same time, we have the social aspects of the porn theatre, in which there would sometimes, in Capino's work on more contemporary theatres in San Francisco and Chicago, there'll be opportunities beyond the screen to have appearances from those being shown in the film, and also opportunities for not just interaction in the way of a handshake and a short conversation, but also more voyeuristic opportunities to kind of like watch them perform on a stage or in a space within that theatre as well.
So are there gay films being played in these porn theaters, or are you talking about a kind of queering of what were predominantly heterosexual spaces showing heterosexual porn films?
Again, this is another distinction that is very interesting to discuss. We have this kind of image of what is meant in terms of this period of sexual liberation, and we talk about the heterosexual films such as Deep Throat, such as the opening of Misty Beethoven quite frequently in these conversations. But a lot of the queer film history is reduced to the footnote of Wakefield Poole's Boys in the Sand, which of course was a landmark achievement in that it was a film which explored Fire Island, which in itself is a very well-known gay and queer sexual space. But it's kind of blown up to be the be-all and end-all of what was being produced at the time. Over on the West Coast, we have filmmakers like Pat Rocco, who Whitney Stroop at Newark discusses as a pioneer in the way of gay softcore film in the 1960s. So we have this kind of contested space in which gay films would not just be shown in porn theatres, because there was no real audience for this yet, but they would be shown alongside art films as well. So we go over to the East Coast and we go over to the space of New York. We have cinemas such as the 55th Street Playhouse, where filmmakers such as Warhol and a lot of European imports would be playing. But on the bill, there may be the occasional gay softcore film as well. We cut to the 1970s and we have sort of a new shift towards hardcore, in which the gay film industry almost comes into hardcore, not in a sort of like delay, but almost in parallel in what Jack Stevenson discusses in his work. He talks about auteurs such as Jack DeVoe, talks about Jerry Douglas and Peter DeRome, and talks about how their work ends up playing in theatres which will begin in the same sort of like art world and kind of contested space in which there's a mixed bill, but eventually will carve out their own distinctive spaces in theatres such as the Adonis and such as co-occupying bills in heterosexual porn theatres as well.
So these places could sometimes be a way for underground filmmakers to disseminate their work as well, like Peter DeRome and things like that.
Absolutely.
And so they become an opportunity for artists.
Yes.
But they're predominantly, are you thinking these are gay porn theatres though at this point, or just porn theatres generally?
Well, this is the thing in which we have like this...
But how do they... I'll ask the question again. So what do they... So how do they put gay programming onto a porn theatre that was typically showing heterosexual films? Was that a thing that happened?
This is a thing in which it's a very early stage of the research, but it's interesting to see how models which have existed in the film industry for decades prior, such as vertical integration, would have weight in the gay pornography industry as well. I mentioned previously the 55th Street Playhouse and the Adonis Theatre. We have filmmakers like Jack DeVoe, who had their own production companies, which for him was hand-in-hand films, in which they would shoot the film, they would distribute it through their own channels as celluloid film stock, and later as video recorded and home viewing for the home viewing market. But would also, and this surprised me in my sort of interaction with the Marco Siedelman edited collection Good Hot Stuff, they would also have understandings with certain theatres in the city in which they could almost four-wall a venue and show their work in a space which was guaranteed to get results. So you have things like at the 55th Street Playhouse, earlier films such as Flaming Creatures, which pushed the boundaries and were very much sanctioned in terms of their run. They were not welcome. But you go and you cut to the 1970s, we have this era in which sexual liberation has assumed a much more visible presence in the world of gay politics especially. And we have theatres like the Adonis not coexisting as alongside gay and straight material, but essentially being the picture palace for gay pornography at the time. And we have in that an interesting sort of relationship to the cinema history, in which it starts as the Tivoli, it changes name to the Cameo in the 60s, and then in the 70s we have a transition in which the Adonis begins on Times Square but moves up in name and reputation to what would later be the iconic location on 50th and 8th. So it's a period of transformation in New York which predates a lot of what we think of in this cycle as initiated in the late 70s and early 80s. We have this kind of era in which the cultural transformation of the theatres is happening, but it's not happening on the sort of decimative level, which happens later on, in which we have the Times Square redevelopment project, which wipes out and condemns a lot of the buildings on the condition of their relative disrepair. Sam Delaney's book Times Square Red, Times Square Blue discusses how it would be much easier for the New York authorities to go into a theatre and tell them that it was due to the conditions and the space of the theatre itself and its disrepair that was the reason why they would be evicted, as opposed to what was playing on the screen. Because in the early 70s and late 60s we have this changing legal landscape as to what is deemed as obscenity as well.
Yeah, and I think that that has parallels with some of the legislation against early cinema as well, where it was very much regulated on the fire regulations and things like that, rather than on the regulation of what was happening on screen. You could easily shut down a movie theatre by imposing really strict fire regulations that the theatre couldn't hope to maintain, right? In terms of how many people they could have and seats and things like that. So it's a form of social control in some respects.
Sure.
Can you just tell me a little bit about, and I think you've alluded to it there, but why the period between 1967 and 1980? What's the start point at 1967 and why the end point of 1980?
Well, the reason why, and I've been asked this before, I pick these dates, is that we have in the dates inherent assumptions as to the conventional histories of pornography and its presence in the public eye. We have 1967, which is an oft-cited date of when softcore pornography would go into theatrical distribution, and we have the date of the 1980, but the 80s in general, which are seen as the sort of end of the theatrical and beginnings of the home exhibition life of pornography in especially America, but across the world as it develops. Now, the reason why I chose the dates was a reflexive consideration in which I wanted to pick the dates to interrogate that a bit. They're absolutely not hard and fast rules, but more just a way of entering the conversation and making an intervention. Peter Alalunas of the University of Oregon makes this point in his work on VHS and pornography, in which he talks about the history of video being much relegated to the 1980s, but talks about another academic, Joseph Slade's ethnographic work in New York's porn theatres. And he talks about this revelation in which he read an article by Slade which talks about the quality of the videotapes in Times Square in 1971. And talking about this on this almost like, degree of separation from his revelation was almost a revelation to myself, in that much of the theatrical distribution of the time is kind of on the assumption that we are talking about celluloid. But in terms of the technology which is being alluded to, we have this sort of videotape exhibition predating a lot of the home video exhibition of the time as well, which in itself raised a lot of questions as to how much we actually know about what was going on, even though we are talking about less than half a century ago. In terms of the end point of that, I did want to discuss a period in which theatrical exhibition, no matter if there are venues which are experimenting with video at this stage, I did want to talk about theatrical exhibition as the predominant means of discussing, of going to watch pornography. But if we talk about the earlier context in Jack Stevenson's work about the history of gay pornography, in his excellent chapter From the Bedroom to the Bijou, we have alongside the history of the stag film and the history of home celluloid reels, the again sort of hidden and clandestine world of gay pornography for individual consumption, in which we have regulatory procedures which are less about the standards set by any one organization, but about the technology, again about the Kodak company, and about what their staff would deem as acceptable or unacceptable when they were developing the prints.
So you've got that extra level of kind of gatekeeping.
Absolutely.
Even down to the personal morality of the people who are processing the film stock that's coming their way.
And this is it. This is something that in my own research, it's almost just like it's levels and levels of prohibition, which I'd never even considered. And getting into the sort of heart of it, it's just amazing how some of it even saw the light of day. It's incredible to think about the politics of preservation as well, in that we can talk about a lot of the films, but in terms of archival mandates, we will likely never see a lot of them for lack of funding, interest, agenda in the preservation of the material. It's something in which it has a lot of relevance, I believe, to not just the smaller area of adult film history, but the new challenges that we are experiencing in the move towards digitization and the move towards preservation across film and media studies.
So if it's that difficult, how are you researching this? What are your methods here? What are you undertaking? Are you doing any kind of ethnographic research? Are you doing any interviews? Or is it textual based? What's your methodology here?
The methodology which I'm beginning with is a historical reception study, which will be taken on board archival materials from several archives around the entertainment industry, but crucially archives of queer materials such as magazines, such as travel guides, and essentially any sort of print materials which kind of document the experience, but out of the public eye.
So would these be, so some of these programs would be advertised in these magazines and that you found in the archives?
Some of the programs would be advertised, but as I say, even some of the cinemas in tourist guides would talk about Times Square, and they would talk about specific venues, and not just in terms of cinemas, which is also interesting, but in terms of the wider sexual economy, which cinemas, which bars, which bathhouses, and the proximity to each other.
And they would mention the specifically the gay aspect of this.
Oh yeah.
And these are, what magazines were these? Are these mainstream magazines, or are these travel guides that are for everyone, or travel guides that are specifically aimed at homosexual?
This is a specific gay audience that this is targeting. And trade journals such as Variety, they talk about specific theatres which are showing pornography, but very rarely, if at all, will talk about any theatres which are showing gay hardcore pornography at the time.
So, have you done any research, or are you aware of what the behaviour was of audiences in these spaces? So, were they using the cinemas as a place to meet, or was it exclusively a place of entertainment and watching the screen?
This is something which I discuss in my paper Times Square Strip, which is talks about queer reclamations of space in 1970s hardcore features. Because we have oral histories of the period, such as Sam Delaney's, and we have ethnographic accounts of porn theatres, such as Jose Capino's, but what has maybe not been interrogated enough is how the space of the porn theatre was represented itself in porn films, and specifically in gay hardcore porn films. One of the most cited accounts of this is a film called The Back Row, which had a starring role from the newly crowned gay porn star Casey Donovan, who had been one of the leads in Boys in the Sand, in which it takes you through a day in the life of a New Yorker who starts the film in a porn theatre and witnesses a sexual encounter between two patrons, which is initiated through paralinguistic behaviour, not through an verbal exchange, but through a shifting of a foot, a tugging of a shirt. And a very interesting artistic feature and aesthetic feature in the film is that it is completely free of dialogue, but explores these spaces without any audio, bar the musical score, which has been a much cited, a very popular feature in critical accounts of the film. But it begins in the space of the porn theatre, which in the film I believe is unnamed. So we have in the narrative progression of the back row, the streetwise New Yorker who begins in an unnamed porn theatre, progresses to the Port Authority bus terminal and picks up a sort of unexperienced initiate who is dressed as John Voight's character in Midnight Cowboy, in the cowboy hat and flares, which suggests rural America. They take a trip to Christopher Street via the subway system, explore several of the gay subcultural spaces there, and finish in another porn theatre, in which the streetwise New Yorker character of Casey Donovan kind of inducts the unexperienced character in of George Payne into this world and teaches him several lessons, such as the social aspects in a lot of ways outweigh the screened content, in that to go to a porn theatre would not necessarily be a choice made on the strength of what was playing on the bill, but would be a decision made for what was promised in the cinema going experience.
What kind of sexual content did that contain?
In the back row there is content in which...
Is it hardcore, softcore?
That's hardcore. Hardcore. Yes.
Yeah. And is it feature film?
Feature length film, yeah.
And where is that available?
The back row is a film which in itself was distributed by Hand in Hand. So in terms of distribution in the contemporary context of present day, we have channels which are available, which are through pornography aggregators online,
right,
but less of a formal distribution than it would have received on video cassette.
So it's kind of like retained its notoriety or its fame, but still in kind of marginal spaces that we're talking about. It's not available on DVD, for example, now and things like that. Not to my knowledge.
It may well be, but it would be likely a specialist adult company who would put it out. It would not be available through, say, the BFI, although a notable exception would be the BFI's release of the erotic films of Peter Derone, in which we have a British expatriate director working in New York.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking of, where his films have kind of been reclaimed from a kind of a underground space.
Yes.
And re-put into an art... I mean, they always were in an art space, but now they're being advertised, because it's BFI, through an art film distributor or a distributor that would be associated with art cinema.
Absolutely.
Adam, are you aware of of this being just a uniquely US phenomenon? Or are you aware of any kind of UK equivalent to this?
In terms of the history of gay sexual spaces, and in terms of the transfer between something like Times Square and the City of London, for instance, we have interesting accounts from authors such as Mark Turner, whose backwards glances cruising the queer streets of New York and London talks about the specific similarities and differences between the two worlds, in that we have Times Square, which is a place in which we have dedicated porn theatres in a very small space in the grand scheme of things across a couple of blocks and avenues. Whereas in London, there was specific districts which were coded with this kind of understanding, such as Soho, such as the Theatre District, but it was not as prevalent and not as institutionalized through the space of the porn theater as it would be in the American and the New York context. This kind of crossover between the US and UK context in terms of tea room culture, in which the space of the bathroom was much more of a common ground than the space of the porn theatre, in which, because in the UK it was not as institutionalised, it was not as common a practice within the exhibition context, it was much more common to find these sexual encounters outside of the space of the theatre and in the space of a bathroom or a park.
So can I ask you, and maybe this is either a leading question or an unfair question, so do you think, and this is just to kind of wrap us up really, do you think there's something being lost in terms of the kind of greater acceptance we've got of homosexuality, means we've, which is obviously a good thing, but then what you lose is a kind of sense of romance, danger and subversion that's associated with these cinematic spaces and cinema spaces?
John Waters has an interesting take on this, in which he talks about being what it means to be queer in the modern context, and he talks about it's excellent that we have social progress and we see greater acceptance in this day and age, but by God, have we lost the danger? Now, there's pros and cons to both, but an element which was ever present in the cruising spaces and the sexual spaces of New York was this element of risk across the different spaces such as the piers and the back of meat trucks. It would be this grey area between public and private in which an obscured space would not necessarily guarantee safety or privacy in either regard. So I think something that is important in the project is to think about not just the aspects which are important to adult film history, but also to archival history. So Jeffrey Escoffier has an interesting take on this, in which due to legal restrictions on the representation and distribution of materials which would discuss, not even advocate, but just discuss being queer, being gay, being any sort of iteration of that identity, a lot of what is preserved in the way of that culture is through material such as pornography, in that we have histories not just of sex embedded in this material, but also histories of space in films such as The Back Row, such as A Night at the Adonis, which shows you this cinema space of the Adonis Theatre, which was demolished in the process of the redevelopment of Times Square. Yeah, it was such a crucial space of sociality and of interaction, not just on an intimate sexual level, but in terms of a relational level, in terms of you would know the people who you would enter the theatre in. In Sam Delaney's book, he talks about the absolute travesty of the loss of these networks, in that now much of this work has moved online, and much of the work in terms of sexual interaction has now moved to this level, which is less a tangible physical presence and more of a abstract digital presence. So yeah, I think what is kind of at the core of my thesis and the core of the doctoral research is this element of reclamation is not just on a historical level, but also on an archival level, to talk about not just the value of preserving adult film, but also the value of preserving these histories which have been lost on a visual level in many ways, but have been preserved in these fragments of films which may just be a few hundred feet, but can tell you more than a contested oral history can in a lot of ways, in terms of the cultural geography and the spatial dynamics of these sites of sociality.
Adam Heron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be hoping to check in with Adam as his research develops over the next couple of years. So hopefully we'll have him on as a guest when he's near a publication. Thank you for listening. Newton Talks will return.